This is Between the Covers. I'm Jim Schumach, and welcome. My guest today is journalist, nonfiction writer, memoirist, and novelist Scott Simon. Born in Chicago in 1952, he's the author of the memoir Home and Away. His nonfiction work is Jackie Robinson and the Integration of Baseball. Host of NPR's Weekend Edition with Scott Simon, he is also the author of two novels, Pretty Birds and currently Windy City, just published by Random House. Welcome to Between the Covers, Scott.
Thank you, Jim. Good to be here.
I know you were born in Chicago and grew up elsewhere. What was it like where you were growing up for you?
Gee, you mean in terms of the city or our family?
Well,
or?
Your life and your family.
Well, we moved around a lot, which was kind of the, looking back on it, kind of the signature of our experience. My father was a comedian, and we kept moving from city to city where he got new jobs. Fell out of old jobs and got new ones. I didn't quite know exactly that part of what was aggravating. I mean, I eventually learned I didn't quite know at the time when I was young that what was aggravating his ability to hold a job was his drinking. So we moved around a lot, New York, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., Cleveland. And this had, where it comes to, I guess, my identity, in all things, really, at this point, this had the effect of actually making me feel more of a Chicagoan. Because wherever we went, we were always known as the Chicagoans, just the stamp that we were. So I always powerfully identified that and have always powerfully identified with the city. I mean, you know, look, I had one of the kind of childhoods, and I recollect this every now and then. I mean, I can even remember school counselors eventually talking to me and saying, essentially, you know, Scott, we realize that you've had a very troubled childhood. And I guess they were then thinking about the moving around. They were thinking about my father's drinking, which certainly was no secret. Even I knew about it as I grew older. And they were thinking about my parents' divorce and the death of my sister, all of that happening within a few years. And I guess when you lay it out like that, it sounds just miserable. But it didn't feel that way. I had two parents who loved me greatly. Two parents who had, if I can refer to it this way, a model divorce in that, and my father could be a handful and more. He could be a handful even when he was sober, but of course, when you add to that the problem of alcoholism, more than a handful, a real chore, a weight around my mother's neck. She loved him dearly, but at some point, and this happens in families where alcoholism is a problem, she kind of just chose to take a lifeboat out. She felt she had to do it for me. Almost more than her. She couldn't let their son kind of languish in that environment. So all of which is a way of saying that with every provocation to say richly deserved negative things about my father, she almost never did. The two of them had a model divorce, were terrific parents, never, to my knowledge, stinted or tried to restrict the time that I spent with either of them. So I was not conscious of having an unhappy childhood. Quite the opposite. I had a great time. My father was a comedian. I hung out in nightclubs. Pretty chorus girls kissed me on the top of my soft little brown head. He was a field announcer for two baseball teams, so I went to a lot of baseball games with field announcers, the guy who says batting in the fourth position, number seven. And my mother was bright and funny and a very beautiful woman still. On her third marriage, had a number of suitors who were almost uniformly interesting, and all of them were very kind to me. So I really, really had no complaints.
What kind of work did your mom do?
Well, when she met my father, she was an actress. She was a dancer. She kind of left that when they got married and began a family. She went back to that a little bit. She went back into modeling when she was when she had to go back into the workforce. But like a lot of working models, did lots of stuff other than modeling. So she worked, I cannot imagine this, as a typist for a magazine called Surplus Record, which literally listed the surplus inventory of industrial machinery in the United States, headquartered in Chicago. Boy, doesn't that sound exciting. And she worked at an advertising agency for years, Darcy Advertising, where she was just an assistant to someone who was a media buyer, a very nice woman. But she continued to model. She was the thumb in the Diet Right Save-A-Seal cap. She was the John James Hairspray girl. I even appeared in a commercial with her for Archway Cookies.
Oh, my favorite.
I'm glad you say that. I think ours were the pecan ice bars or pecan sand. No, pecan ice bars.
Mine were the Nutty Buddies.
The Nutty Buddies. Oh, Darn, I wish we'd done that commercial. But as I understand the story, and I don't want to ask too many questions and, you know, and have the truth of it undercut, which been the nice story, they had signed some other little kid to play her kid, her child, in the commercial, and then he was like a contract holdout. You know, his mother asked for more money, and so everything was set up at the Fred Niles studio in the West Loop in Chicago, and in any event, they needed another little kid, and my mother stepped forward and said, well, I have a little boy, and I was about the right age, and so I'll never forget her taking a cab to the school, you know, talking to the principal, getting me out of school, and I came down, and I believe I can still recite my line, which is, gee, Mom, can I have an Archway cookie? I can do that flawlessly, can't
I? That was wonderful.
Thank you very much. Well, I did it like 50 times, as I recall, and I had to bite into a cookie at the end, which, by the way, it's very difficult to bite into a cookie and not have, you know, and smiled at the camera without having at least a little of it linger on the top of your teeth. So I had to do that over and over again.
Were you a voracious reader as a child?
Yeah, I was. My father was. I must say, this was a wonderful trait that he passed on. My mother actually had the sense of humor in the family, against all expectation. My father was the comedian. I shouldn't say against all expectation. That's exactly what I expect now, because my father, like a lot of comedians, could be serious to the point of depressive. My mother, on the other hand, was funny, effervescent, and gregarious. And my father was the reader. He read voraciously and read just about everything. I mean, he read the daily newspapers. He was, back in the day when the New York Times was not available all across the country, he would get the Times in Chicago or everywhere when it was 3 days old. Still felt it was important to read that and read the opinion columns and the news analysis. He would read The Economist. He'd been in the British Army.
Really?
During World War II, and would get, you know, and I think by the time we got a copy of The Economist or somewhere, it was 2 weeks old. He felt it was important to read that. I can't say he read modern fiction, but he read just about everything nonfiction, from something like the Chicago Sun-Times, which was a tabloid newspaper in all senses of the word at that particular point, to the New York Times and The Economist. And, my God, Reader's Digest, Saturday Evening Post, absolutely everything. He was restless. He was, interestingly, like many alcoholics, he had bouts of insomnia, which I guess doctors have explained to me over the years is something about the alcohol in your system. So despite the fact that you're exhausted and dead tired, you can't sleep. And he would read.
I think the sugar hits your system late at night.
That's it. I think that's what happens, yeah.
Well, what were the first books that really intrigued you and absolutely enthralled you, drew you into them, their world?
You know, it's interesting, and conveniently, I'm sure Dr. Seuss I know Dr. Seuss when I was a youngster, because I liked the wordplay. I was also a bit of a sickly kid. My mother actually did read Shakespeare to me when she had been a young drama student at the Goodman School of Drama in Chicago. Of course, everybody studied Shakespeare, and she had a great love of Shakespeare, and she would read Shakespeare to me. And it's really the best way, I mean, save for the illness, I think it's, but even considering that, almost the best way to get introduced to Shakespeare, because, you know, it's something for your enjoyment, your delectation. It's not a school assignment. So that really had a powerful effect on me. All of that being said, it's interesting. I remember distinctly, and of course now I'm on tour with this book, Windy City, which is a political comedy. I was, I guess we'd have to do the math, but I was like, I guess 10, no, I was 10 years old or something when John Kennedy died. John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Or I was 11, 1963. Overwhelming event for all of us who were youngsters at that particular point. And John Kennedy had been a great hero of my boyhood. And my Auntie Chris, who was the, I think it's fair to say, even still the lone Republican in the family, my Auntie Chris, with great vast respect for the loss I had suffered, gave me an old copy of a book called The Last Hurrah by Edwin O'Connor, the great political comedy set in Boston. I was 12 years old and loved that book.
Me too. I read it about the same age.
It was just terrific. I just found myself transformed by that. It was funny and moving, and, you know, looking back on it, and I have reread it every few years, and certainly read it before I set off to write Windy City. I really loved that book, and it opened something up to me, in a way, looking back on it. Being a Chicagoan, reading about aldermen in the Sun-Times and the tabloids and the Chicago City Council and politics, and I mean, it's not so good a story as I can say I vowed when I was 12 one day I would write a political comedy. But that book, which was a great political comedy, was really instrumental in opening up modern literature of a different kind to me. I read everything by Edwin O'Connor. I think he was actually dead by the time I read that. He died too young, in his late 40s, as I recall. And he wrote a wonderful book that also connected with me that's called I Was Dancing, which is about an old vaudevillian. And, of course, my father had been in music hall and was not as old as the character in the book, but this was also a man with a history and show business, and that touched me deeply. And then a great book called The Edge of Sadness, which was about a priest with a drinking problem, not unlike my father's. And so I just, you know, Edwin O'Connor should not be mentioned in the same breath as William Shakespeare, to be sure. But he was an example, I think, of a kind of figure we could use more these days. He was an example of a serious and funny artist who happened to write very popular books, although perhaps nothing as popular as The Last Hurrah, but all of his books were popular, and he had a vast reading public, or a large-sized reading public. And he was a good and honest craftsman, and I sometimes think that middle step is missing in fiction these days.
I absolutely agree.
The popular books, the wildly popular books, and I cast no aspersions, I just wish I was there myself, but I mean, the wildly popular books are often not of pronounced literary quality, and sometimes the book of pronounced literary quality are not always accessible, don't reach out to people in a certain way. And Edwin O'Connor, I think, was really a great craftsman that way.
What about your coming of age? Was there serious literature in that period?
Yeah, I went through a period, which I almost never got over, of inhaling everything Norman Mailer ever wrote. And when I say everything he ever wrote, it was, you know, he was wonderful about putting everything he ever wrote more or less into collections. So it was not just a matter of his fiction, which I liked a lot. I even liked The Deer Park, which I remember Mailer on many occasions writing, you know, something like he loved The Deer Park above all others, but nobody else seemed to. Well, I loved The Deer Park. And I still remember the phrase from there, Marty made it, Marty made it, when Marty, the producer, has an orgasm. I can say that on this show, right? Orgasm you can say on any show.
You can say that.
Okay. And Cannibals and Christians is a wonderful collection of the essays, poetry, every just bits and shards of everything he wrote over the years. His an amazing article I still remember on modern architecture. You can forget that Mailer was actually an engineering student at Harvard. He did not come out of arts and literature background, and it really opened my eyes to seeing the skyline differently, Chicago being a great place to see the skyline. I was just fascinated by everything Mailer wrote. Of course, he had this great, sometimes purple style, and you can imagine me trying to imitate that in high school. You know,
with your vast background.
Yeah, with my vast background, my unrivaled knowledge of all the things that, you know, that Mailer knew about. So, I'm sure that was awfully hard to take, and thank you for my teachers for understanding that I was trying to work my way through to something. But so I read everything by Norman Mailer and loved it. He was, I think, the two authors who were most important to me at that stage in my life and coming of age. And part of it also was I've been identified with, I must say, Mailer's political writing at that particular time, Miami and the Siege of Chicago, Armies of the Night. All of that was important in opening my eyes and touching me, and also making me see the writer as a kind of a useful figure. And also James Agee. I had read Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, which is a much more famous volume, I gather, than it was when it came out during the Depression, where, as I recall the story, it was private, had to be privately published. You know the story, he'd written it while on assignment for Fortune magazine in the Depression in the South, and I guess Fortune didn't publish it, or published a very watered-down version of it, but recognized that it was an extraordinary work and gave him the right to publish it, but it wound up being privately published and didn't, I think, really see a mass print edition until, I think he might have been gone too, but it's a great work. Absolutely vivid telling detail about life during the Depression in Alabama. And then I read A Death in the Family, which is about the death of the father of a family and a boy, obviously modeled on him, named young Rufus. And that led me to reading Agee's journalism, which he was fitful about producing for time and fortune, but he did it anyway, and his movie reviews, which are just terrific.
He had a tough life, too, didn't he?
Well, he lost his father when he was young, 8, maybe something like that, if I'm not mistaken. From a family of some means, I don't mean wasn't part of privileged hierarchy, but I mean, you know, he wasn't in Depression, Alabama, but he was in upper middle class Knoxville, Tennessee at that particular point. I mean, his description in A Death in the Family of, I remember it begins more or less, we are speaking of Knoxville now on a summer night, colon, and then he describes the night in Knoxville and the fetid air and the sound of the flies. I make no comparisons with my own work, okay? I truly don't. But that being said, it was certainly on my mind when I wrote a section in Windy City about describing winter in Chicago. It seemed to me that when he was writing about the, what we sometimes call it, the dead of a humid summer in Knoxville, Tennessee, he was choosing to write about what you could find to love in what even people who lived in Knoxville would consider the unloveliest time of the year. And when I write a section about winter in Chicago and Windy City, I have purposely chosen what a lot of people who live there find that they can love in what's considered the unloveliest time of the year there. What is the unloveliest time of the year there?
For those of you who have just joined us, this is Jim Schumach with Between the Covers. My guest today is journalist, nonfiction writer, memoirist, and novelist Scott Simon. How did you first get involved in radio?
Well, it's interesting. I didn't think of it as getting involved in radio, although demonstrably
most people
it is.
Don't.
Yeah, I guess that's an old story, isn't it? I was actually working for the public television station in Chicago, Channel 11. I was a reporter, and I was covering crime and politics. And there's often a cross-pollination between the two. All Things Considered was the only program that NPR had on the air that night, and our news program at Channel 11 went on at 7 o'clock every night. And at 5 o'clock every night, in those days in the Midwest, the time has moved up, obviously, by a couple of hours, a show called All Things Considered went on the air. And I often, even in those days, working at Channel 11, I often did essays. Mind you, this was the public television station, so we had 4 reporters, only 2 camera crews. How many camera crews did the commercial television stations have? More than 20, you know, at least. So there were some stories that were just left to be done by essays. And the news director, John Calloway, rather liked my writing and thought that there were lots of things we could do, just handle as an essay I would do set to photographs taken by a very gifted photographer named John Randolph. So we would be in John's studio at Channel 11 in Chicago trying to set script to photograph and change the script to accommodate his photograph. You know, our show went on the air at 7, so 5, you know, really those 2 hours we were often spent in his studio. And that's when I first heard All Things Considered, and I thought it was the best journalism I'd ever encountered in any medium. I thought it was terrific. I was intrigued by it. I had never done radio. I mean, I listened to the radio, that sort of thing. But I just wrote a letter to NPR in Washington saying I would like to. It was clear listening to it then that they really only had people on the East Coast and maybe a couple of people in the Bay Area and lots of people in Minnesota. Still do. I wrote a letter and ultimately got a phone call. Yeah, the guy said, well, no promises, but you're free to try anything. Why don't you go in and talk to some people at our local station, WBEZ, which I did. Bought a tape recorder, went out, and the first piece that I did, which, I wish I could tell you it was something better, but it was Jimmy Carter had become the nominee of the Democratic Party for president, and he gave a speech at the Chicago County Democratic Organization, what we used to call the Machine, with Mayor Daley. And Jimmy Carter gave a speech in which you could tell he was trying to hit all the stops on the organ, you know, and great Mayor Daley, and he would talk about, he would talk about the great Adlai Stevenson, who was twice the nominee of our party. I mean, a very effective political speech where he was kissing the hem of Mayor Daley's garment and the Chicago Democratic Organization. This was at a time when a lot of people wondered, you know, was Carter their kind of guy? Would the Chicago Machine turn out for Jimmy Carter as they once had for Jack Kennedy? Well, probably never again the way they did for Jack Kennedy, but in any event. So there were a lot of questions being raised about that. And Predator, he was then Governor Carter, gave a very effective presentation. Mayor Daley got up, and I thought a lot of the national reporters were laughing at what they thought were a bunch of non sequiturs. And so I did a piece pointing out where the stuff that Mayor Daley had said was not a non sequitur at all, but in its own way was every bit as deft a recital in which he was trying to play all the stops on the organ that would tickle the audience there, as Jimmy Carter had made. It just was maybe, I thought, lost on a lot of national reporters. So, for example, Merv Dealey would say, and remember, Jimmy Carter's from Georgia. And Georgia's a great state. They voted for Adlai Stevenson twice. You know, big. You know, and to a lot of national reporters, that the logic of that was just lost on them. But, of course, to the people who were members of the Chicago Democratic machine, that was a way of announcing, this guy produced for us. We have to produce for him. And in fact, Merv Dealey's conclusion, as I recall, was something like, so I present to you the man who's going to do for us if we do for him. You don't get any more blunt than that. You know, the man who's going to do for us, meaning he'll let us have some jobs, he'll give us appointments to federal commissions, he'll put some patronage our way, he'll be good to us with the federal budget if we do for him, meaning if we turn out the vote, then Jimmy Carter of Georgia. And I did a piece pointing that out. And I needed all kinds of help putting it together technically, but NPR liked it. I continued to freelance for NPR, and then Merv Dealey, this was the piece I did for them, and I'm sorry to go on so long, was right around the time of Columbus Day, because the two of them marched in the Columbus Day parade. And Jimmy Carter, of course, was elected president, and that December, Merv Dealey died. So I did a lot of pieces for NPR about Merv Dealey's death and the struggle, scramble, really, to succeed him. And then, incredibly enough, just a few days before Christmas, an L train on the L tracks that encircled the loop downtown crashed. I believe the first time, like in 70-some years, that had happened. So that was a big national story, and I covered that. So I wound up doing so much freelance work. NPR apparently liked it and offered me a staff job based in Chicago. And more or less, that's how I got there.
You mentioned my favorite journalist, David Halberstam, in the acknowledgments in your book. What did he mean to you?
He was actually married to someone who worked with me at Channel 11, Gene Halberstam, Gene Butler Halberstam. He was just a wonderful fellow, and I knew him for a long time. And he enlisted me on a couple of projects when I could use the work and use the experience, and was always just a wonderful source of wisdom and counsel and a very ready dinner table. I met all kinds of famous and interesting and some not so interesting, but certainly noteworthy people at the Halberstam dinner table. Neil Sheehan, Ray Bonner, who I later got to know in El Salvador. These were all the great war correspondents of that particular time. They just, you know, even when I began to write novels, because he had written one novel.
One Very Hot Day.
My God.
One of my favorites of Vietnam, and he predicted how we would fail in Vietnam.
Well, I guess he did in his nonfiction too, but I mean it was apparent there. And he said to me as we were talking about it, because I said that Sarajevo had moved me deeply, and I wanted to write a book, and I wanted to try a novel, and maybe I'd always wanted to try a novel. And he said, "Well, my boy, I just wrote that one novel because I sensed that it was not in the end my métier. But you know what you have to do, my son," is what George called me my son. I think he called a lot of us his son. "What you have to do, my son, is you have to have a sign hanging over your computer every day when you go to work, and it says, 'My imagination resides here.'" And, of course, my wife made that sign for me. In fact, it still resides in my writing office now.
Other than the assassination of Kennedy, was there one person or political event that really kind of galvanized your own political consciousness?
Well, I think certainly the 68 Democratic Convention in Chicago. I was 16 at the time, and my father, interestingly, had died that June. June 6th, Robert Kennedy was assassinated. Dr. King had been assassinated April, just a few months before that. It was a very powerful year. My father died on June 24th, and I don't mean to compare. Certainly, I'd be the only one to put those three events together, but they certainly all ran together in my mind. And then, of course, that August was the Democratic Convention in Chicago. And it's interesting. I happened to be on the same forum as Tom Hayden just a few weeks ago in Chicago, where the occasion was whatever anniversary it was of the Chicago conspiracy trial. And I was in the park, although, to say the least, his contribution is far more remembered than mine is, and his experience is certainly more interesting than mine. But one of the things I talked about with Tom is I always resented it at the time and even years after the fact when people would say to me something like, you know, or even Mayor Daley, God rest his soul, would say there were a lot of out-of-towners coming here. There were a lot of out-of-towners who came there. Of course, Chicago had invited a lot of out-of-towners for the convention. But my memory as you walked around the park were those were mostly Chicago kids. I mean, were there kids from California and New York? Yeah, absolutely. But, I mean, the people my age, the high school and college-age students, seemed to me to be overwhelmingly from Chicago. That might be the least significant point to remember. And my grandfather, by the way, was a Chicago cop, a police sergeant. And I'm not someone who liked to hear the chant, pigs, 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 because I knew my grandfather, and he wasn't. We disagreed about everything, but I didn't like to hear that kind of vicious stereotype. All of that being said, I thought the police certainly behaved in a disreputable way. I wasn't beaten. It's not that good a story. I just remember running a lot from the sickly smell of the tear gas. But, yes, that was an absolutely important event, because it seemed to me in a way that's very difficult to recapture now, that something in the political system had gotten so badly broken, popular will was getting so frustrated, that this was all spilling out into the streets. I don't know, as I felt at the time, that a revolution was in the offing, but an awful lot of people did. And I mean, that didn't seem to be a histrionic belief under any circumstance whatsoever. So I think that had a lot to do with forming my opinion at that particular time.
Well, and there were millions of veterans returning home with a lot of experience with weaponry.
Yes, right. Thank you. We should remind ourselves of that. That's absolutely the case.
What's the most difficult assignment you've ever covered?
You know, there are kind of two answers to that. Well, at least two answers to that. I mean, in terms of physical hazard, but also emotional investment, undoubtedly the siege of Sarajevo, where the city was constantly under sniper and artillery fire at that particular point. And it was not a safe assignment under any circumstance. On the other hand, I don't call it a difficult story, because the story was there and apparent, and there was a lot for a reporter to do. I mean, the most difficult story, I'm afraid, and I hope I'm not being just provocative here, is when you have to do the 10th news spot about a 6-inch snow in the Midwest and say something different. That really is a challenge of your repertorial skills. The unfortunate fact about, tragic fact about Sarajevo was that there was always new death and suffering and destruction, so there was always a story that you could find. Sometimes your repertorial skills get tested by the most mundane stories, where it's something that's still important, but you have to try and find something new or different or interesting to say. But, nothing compares to me with covering the siege of Sarajevo for just the emotional experience and investment connection it made with me.
Well, it was a number of years afterwards that you wrote your novel. Were you letting the story build within you? Or did you know it was there?
I guess I knew it was there, but it had to build within me. What I did not want to do, and, you know, I wrote 103 pages, and then my agent began to take it around to publishers. And I had a luncheon in New York with a nice woman who then headed a major publishing firm. And she said, you know, Scott, it would really help us sell this book if you could put a journalist in it. I didn't want to do that. I thought that was phony. I did not want to write a book that was a thinly fictionalized version of what I had observed. For one thing, that wasn't a very interesting book. You know, my war was certainly no more hazardous or interesting than anybody else's. And there have been a number of good nonfiction books written in that realm. I didn't want to write some thinly fictionalized novel that made the reporter the narrative center, because I thought that was phony. One of the things that I thought Sarajevo helped me to understand is that although we reporters can share some of the physical hazards of a story, we don't share the loss, the destruction of our society. We certainly don't share the stake in the outcome. I mean, I would tell you that every civilized human being had a stake in the survival of Sarajevo, but I can't pretend that after I'd gotten on a plane and left, it would have made that much immediate difference in my own life. And that was not true of the people in Sarajevo, obviously, who I think could fairly conclude by what they had heard about and observed in places like Vukovar and most famously Srebrenica, that surrender wasn't even an option for them. So I thought it was just phony and wrong to build a story around a journalist, and I didn't want to do that. I thought the story of Sarajevo was that individual Sarajevans, who were in no way martial or warlike, you know, who considered themselves sophisticated and cosmopolitan, and were, you know, had undertaken to provide for their own survival. You know, past a certain point, they had weren't even wailing for the world to intervene anymore. They had undertaken to save themselves, and I found that story very moving. And that's the story I wanted to tell using a Sarajevan family, as using their eyes as the narrative center. And ultimately, two teenage girls. And it's interesting because I've been asked, you know, the book has been out for 3 years now and done quite well. Isn't it odd for a man of your vintage to build a story around two teenage girls? And I guess it is. I hadn't thought about it. But when I covered the siege of Sarajevo, it was ruled by teenagers during the day because teenage boys were off in the army. Parents and grandparents, as a generalization, were cooped up in apartments by sniper and artillery fire. So it was the teenage girls who really went out, ran errands. When I say errands, you know, there's no store, so not down to the store. They would brave sniper and artillery fire to go to the, I think they had as many as 9 taps of water open in the whole city at one point, or go out to try and receive relief supplies from United Nations soldiers. So the world I knew covering the siege of Sarajevo. So that's why I found it very natural to tell the story of two teenage girls.
They're rather well-known basketball players and snipers. Yes. So all of which leads to some amazing protagonists for your story.
Well, I felt that too, and I felt that was more interesting than... I preferred to tell that story than I did to use the phony bit of her. You know, we've all read novels like that, the reporter that writes the thinly fictionalized version of something, and some are better than others, but I just didn't see mine as being good.
Well, since you've opened up the story, but why don't you give us a reading from your book? This is Jim Schumach with Between the Covers. My guest today is Scott Simon, and he's reading from his first novel, Pretty Bird.
Most people in town didn't have a September 1st or a December 7th in their minds, a day they could say the war began. Sarajevo had a plaque at the spot where, on June 28th, the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand had lit the fuse to World War. Grotesque men strutting in jackboots and gingerbread uniforms struck up wars. Wars weren't begun by people who wore soft French jeans and stylish running shoes. There were blood wars in the hinterlands, feuds, really, among country people who clung to their father's work, their grandfather's lands, and the primitive bigotry of their forebears. But Sarajevans considered themselves refined. They didn't live in the woods, but along a crossroads. People intermingled, intertwined, and intermarried. Few families couldn't trace at least a drop of all bloodlines into their own. People might be Muslims or Serbs, or even Catholics or Jews at birth. They became city people by custom. They found more faith in coffee houses and movie theaters than in churches or mosques. They were obedient to Billie Holiday, Beckett, and basketball, not ministers or imams. The rest of what had been Yugoslavia might be broken up by blood grudges, but Sarajevans were convinced that they could find sly ways to maneuver around tribalism, as they had around communism. Sarajevans could be stupid, brutish, and blinkered between the river and the valley. They could be irrational, indolent, and self-indulgent in their cafes. They joked about it themselves. But the sheer, blunt dumbness of war, it didn't fit. The plaque marking the shooting of the Archduke extolled the assassination as a blow for Serbian nationalism, but Sarajevans usually strolled past the brass tablet without giving it as much notice as a soft drink ad. So each Sarajevan had a different date for the start of the war. It began in that moment they said to themselves, "This will not be over by morning." For Irena Zarich, the war began on a greening weekend in early April. Young Sarajevans who wanted Bosnia to stay peacefully together were marching downtown. Many people at her school were going. Eddie Vidoliak had asked her to go. But Irena knew that Eddie's interest in the endurance of a multi-ethnic democracy was hoping to impress girls of various backgrounds with old myths. "You know what they say about Croat men, don't you?" he would say with a toss of his dark, disheveled head. "You know why all kinds all over the world they're crazy for us, don't you? I could help you find out." Eddie was harmless in small doses and dependably amusing, but Irena had basketball practice at 11 in the morning. She couldn't miss a workout so close to their sectional championships. Irena and her teammates were often teased about being jocks, mocked for having no concern for history, culture, or politics. But they knew that basketball now competed with political assemblies on Friday nights. The city bristled with national fronts, liberation movements, and people assemblies, all making raucous vows in smoky basements. It could even be risky to drive across the river for a basketball game, or to buy a string of sausage. They knew that some Serb police had taken off their uniforms and badges and overturned a garden store delivery truck along the Brotherhood and Unity Bridge. The defrocked police, now anointed paramilitaries, swept aside the tulips and sunflowers and set up a barrier. No other police would dare to remove it. Men in black sweaters with rifles on their hips barked at people to show identity cards before passing into what they called Serb Sarajevo. Just a week earlier, the school principal, Miss Ferens, had introduced the men's and women's basketball teams at a school assembly in the gym. She presented the players by position and declared, "There you hear it! Serb names, Croat names, Muslim names!" She turned slightly toward Miriam Iskovic, but kept her lips above the microphone so her stage whisper would not be lost. "Even a Jewish name," she said to satisfying chimes of laughter. Miriam blushed at being singled out. She was a sweet, studious girl who rarely made it into games of consequence. The principal continued in a soft tone, "Serbs, Croats, Muslims, Jews, they are all our family names here in Number 3 High School in Grbavica. Different names, different histories. Today," Miss Ferens fairly thundered, "we all play for the same team, our team, just like every citizen of Sarajevo." The students rose to their feet, folding chairs scraping, clapping their hands above their heads. The speech gave them a new stake in winning. Grbavica couldn't lose to a team like Number 1 High School over in Bistrik, where only Muslims lived. It would let down all Sarajevo. "Let's show all Bosnia," Miss Ferens turned her right arm above her head as if she were ringing a bell. Her glasses slipped down her nose. "Muslims, Serbs, Croats, Jews, Rastas, Hindus, Buddhists, Jains, Shintoists, Scientologists." Miss Ferens ran out of religions just in time for the laughter to overtake her.
Thanks for reading that, Scott.
My pleasure. Yeah.
When I think of the movie Vukovar, reminds me of Marcel Marceau's Children of Paradise, which was filmed in Paris during the occupation.
Yeah.
Vukovar was filmed while Vukovar was being destroyed. You've seen the movie, I take it, haven't you?
I have, yeah.
And what did you think?
Of the movie?
Mm-hmm.
Very effectively done. What can I say? That period will always be difficult for me to talk about. And in part, it made me want to be a novelist, too. Well, for a couple of reasons. It affected me so deeply. I think that novels can reach in and affect people in a different way than nonfiction can, and certainly broadcast reporting can. And it was not lost on me. I had been part of a generation that felt, well, if people just know the truth, damn it, the world will prevent something from happening. And I think the world doesn't have any excuse for what happened in Germany during the 1930s and 40s, and we certainly don't have one for what happened in that area of the world in the 1990s, because I think actually a lot of the news organizations in the United States and Western Europe did a very good job about reporting it. This was not a matter of, there was junk news even then, but this was not a matter of, oh, people didn't know because there was so much O.J. Simpson coverage. I went back, I read all the news, it was all there, it was all reported in real time. And this is something that the world set back and let it happen, which is another reason why I thought it was wrong to put a journalist at the center of the story that I told in Pretty Birds.
Your new novel, Windy City, tells the tale of the murder of the mayor of Chicago. What interests me most about the novel is not only the facts of the murder, but the system of government, which is aldermanic. How does that differ from other forms?
Well, the City Council of Chicago is the biggest proportionately in the country. They have 50 people there. New York has 51, but of course it's a substantially larger city. And because of that, the representation is often sort of by neighborhood, community by community. So the aldermen are city council members. And by the way, the term by statute is alderman. You don't flatter a woman who happens to be an alderman by calling her alderwoman. That's just not the title. They are the representative to the city council in government, and they have to vote on all legislation that's proposed by the mayor and by themselves, but also they become kind of little mayors within their own right. They're the ones who are held responsible for getting the snow plows out, for getting dead trees taken down, for helping people to get jobs, liaison with the schools, with all of city bureaucracy. I wanted to write a political comedy, and I felt if you look, The Last Hurrah is a great book. And that's a mayor, and I didn't want to do that. The Gay Place, Billy Lee Brammer's novel about the Texas legislature, that's a governor, and I didn't want to do that. But I also think when you get to governors and senators, Advise and Consent, which was written by Alan Drury, I think, in 1959, which I read after the last hurrah, is a great novel, great, big, thick book about the Senate and how it works, and great, colorful characters. He kind of went off the deep end in his books after that, but all things considered, why would I say that? Advise and Consent, I think, remains a great novel, and significantly, I think, the only thing Alan Drury did that's reprinted. Won the Pulitzer Prize, though. Nowadays, if you write a book that is about senators or governors or even congressmen, you're writing about their aides as much as you are writing about them. I think a lot of what we call government is actually conducted by aides, and even the negotiations between various parties are all conducted by aides. I'm not saying that there's not a great novel there, or even a good one, but I wanted to try and capture politicians actually talking to each other. And so the lowest position on the food chain, really, and to some people's minds, the lowest position on earth, is probably being a Chicago alderman. I also knew from having covered Chicago politics enough, albeit in my youth, but certainly back in Chicago enough to understand, a lot of aldermen are significantly colorful characters. Let's put it that way. Loquacious and funny, even if they don't always mean to be. And I thought that setting a story among them was potentially interesting. And you could grab the interaction with each of them, with each other. And I don't want to refer to the Chicago system as being totally unique, although it is the largest city council. But I chose also not to set the story in New York or Los Angeles. And I certainly didn't even want to trifle with Boston because after the last hurrah. But firstly, I don't. New York, I like to think I know to a degree. But you could choose any city as a novelist and then study it. But I think if you'd set the story in New York or Los Angeles, it's too easy to say, well, that's just New York or Los Angeles. Chicago, we tell ourselves that Chicago says something about the country. And Chicago politics is a kind of local specialty, just like the blues or improvisational comedy. And like those local specialties, it goes national. I mean, you have the example this year, obviously, of two Chicagoans running against each other for the Democratic nomination for president. But even before then, you know, a lot of campaign managers, a lot of campaign people, for that matter, a lot of national political reporters have all spent time in Chicago, be it David Broder or David Brooks. They've all spent time there. And I think that's there's a lot to be said for the fact that there's just something in the blood and the bones of Chicago. And if people succeed there, either practicing or covering politics, it makes them ready for the national exposure.
Well, speaking of blood and bones, it's the city of the big shoulders.
Yeah, it is right? The city of the big shoulders. Although now a city council that has banned foie gras, which I think is a measure of how much things have changed. I do think Chicago politics is a lot cleaner than it used to be. And that's happened over the past generation, and it's been federal law, it's been enforcement of federal law, it's been several U.S. attorneys who've been willing to go to the mat over this. For that matter, it was the state's attorney of Cook County, Illinois, named Richard M. Daley, who's now the mayor, who I think understood it was just a different era, and the public was going to demand something more honest. So I have one of my characters in Windy City complains that, you know, what's it getting to nowadays when you can get a job for your a total stranger easier than you can for your brother-in-law? That's the case. There's still chicaneries, and there's still people, obviously, who get indicted and go to prison in Chicago. But it's a lot more clean a game than it used to be, although still very much a contact sport.
Well, is it ruled by simple majority, or are there other things involved?
City Council is ruled by simple majority, and that's it's interesting because this Mayor Daley, like his father, is considered a strong mayor, less because of the constitutional provision, because it's a strong city council under the laws, more than it is a strong mayor. But he has an active working majority in the city council that gets a lot of stuff passed that he wants. His father was more effective at that part of it, because his father also controlled the Cook County Democratic Organization. So arguably almost everybody in that city council who was a Democrat, and they were all Democrats. I don't think there's been a Republican in the Chicago City Council for years. I know there hasn't been one for years. They felt that they owed a great deal of their livelihood and their political prosperity to Mayor Daley. This Mayor Daley has less, I mean, he has his favorites in the council, but he has kind of less unitary control. And in a way, that makes him more popular. And for example, he was against the ban on foie gras. He thought that's utterly ridiculous. It's going to make us the laughingstock of the nation if we're not already. But, you know, I mean, that's a relatively minor issue. On the other hand, he does have the power of the mayor's office. So he's someone that I sometimes refer to him as a panzer environmentalist. When he decided he wanted to make Meigs Field, which was the downtown lakefront airport, into a park, it was just wrong to have an airport there. You make it into a park. He got tired of talking about it and one morning sent the bulldozers in. And sure enough, it's a park. Because he knew no one's going to turn it into an airport again.
Would you say that the ethnic groups in Chicago have intermingled better than the groups have in New York, or not?
I guess I wouldn't go that far with any confidence. I couldn't go that far. In both cities, there's an impressive collection of groups. When I was making up the composition of Chicago City Council members in my book, and my wife actually makes up all the names of all the principal characters in my book, and her great achievement is to name all 50 members of the Chicago City Council here, I gave her a demographic description, demographic and sometimes vocational description of every member of the City Council I wanted. And I began with the proportions that kind of exist in the Chicago City Council now. And I added one more Asian, in fact, my hero, Sonny Rapini. And I made a couple of differences. But in this present Chicago City Council, in real life, there are only 4 people of Irish ancestry. Fascinating for all the stereotypes we have. And 2 of them, in fact, are from a mixed ethnic background. For that matter, I'm from an Irish family, but an Irish-Jewish family, mixed ethnic background. And I think in Chicago, this is obviously increasingly common. I mean, do we need another more prominent example than Barack Obama? I think mixed ethnicity is becoming its kind of own identity. So you can no longer really effectively refer to an Irish bloc in the Chicago City Council or an Italian bloc, because even if they voted that way, and I don't think they do, the people tend to be from a mixed ethnic background. And I think that's probably happened in big cities all over the country where immigration has been a fact of life.
What's the best of Chicago from your point of view, Scott?
Oh, I'll answer it from my wife's point of view. My wife is French, and when we married, what she knew of the United States tended to be New York and the Bay Area. She had changed planes in Chicago and changed planes in Dallas and I think Atlanta. That was it. She loves Chicago now. And she says she thinks it is one of the great cities of the world, along with New York and London. It is one of the great international cities of the world. She's from the north of France, so she has a disdain for Paris. You know, she has the attitude, Paris is great if you could just take the people out of it. But even she points out Paris doesn't have the international composition in the population that New York, London, and Chicago have. And I think Los Angeles, too, I would add to that list. She is just enlivened by Chicago. She says it has all the assets of New York that people boast about in New York in terms of cultural opportunities, really some of the best theater, obviously, in the country. Certainly some of the best music, jazz, blues, but for that matter, all the way through to classical. Comedy, improvisational theater, certainly some of the best restaurants. I happened to win a James Beard Award for food writing. I wrote an article about food and war zones for Gourmet magazine.
Really?
And it was, yeah, won the James Beard Award last year. And it was not lost on us at those ceremonies that receiving the awards for best restaurants in the country were all Chicago people. They're Rick Bayless, Gail Gund, I could go on, Charlie Trotter. So it's got all of what we consider to be the assets of a great city, of let's say New York City. Except my wife, who loves New York, finds it much friendlier. She says people in Chicago are much friendlier, much funnier. They just tend to take note of you in a way, she says, New Yorkers can often walk past you. So I think it all resides in that, some of the personality and some of the sense of humor of the city, which, by the way, I hope is reflected in Windy City.
In all the political infighting, corruption you've seen, has anything really shocked you or blown you away that you've seen?
Of course, there's a story that's on my mind that may not be the acid answer, in that other things could occur to me. There's a man in the Chicago City Council named Dick Mell, and this is as much a story about newspapers as much as it is about politics. Alderman Mell, alderman on the southwest side, by the way, happens to be the father-in-law of the governor, Governor Blagojevich, and the two of them do not get along to all outward appearances. In any event, this was a number of years ago. There was a suspicious correlation in Alderman Mell's ward between the streets that got plowed and the street where he lived, the street where his assistant lived, the street where his secretary lived, the streets where big contributors lived, all that sort of thing. Absolute correlation. I know somebody, a concerned citizen, that brought that to the attention of the Chicago Tribune, and this was, as memory serves, like 6 weeks before the election. The Tribune said, well, it all seemed to be superficial. They didn't follow up on it. 9 months after Alderman Mell was safely reelected, who's a very powerful alderman, the Tribune, in fact, ran a story talking about how city services in the war tended to be disproportionately lavished on those streets where he had big contributors and friends and associates, and wound up accepting a Pulitzer Prize. And I just found that so, I must say, so cynical. That the newspaper, okay, hold your horses, not enough now, thanks very much. But they wind up with a straight face winning and accepting a Pulitzer Prize and getting lauded for their courage. What it, you know, it seems to me they could have done the story earlier if they were going to be courageous about it. And I'm not sure that would have made any difference to the alderman's reelection.
Why don't you give us your take on the dailies? What do you think they brought to the city of Chicago, and what do you think they've taken away from it?
I wouldn't put the dailies in the same breadth.
Okay.
Interestingly, I mean, did they have some shared traits? Inevitably, fathers and sons do. The elder Mayor Daley, Richard J. Daley's, I think his most impressive traits were his tenacity, his sense of purpose. He thought big for Chicago. He wanted to make it a world-class city, and did. He actually brought very fine administrators to town and more or less gave them their own head. He had a lot of drawbacks, though. He didn't see the city fairly. He undoubtedly didn't include African-Americans. I mean, there were people you could point to, African-Americans, who were his allies, but I think he didn't. He did not include them as full and equal partners in the Chicago Democratic Organization, although you had people like Big Bill Dawson and Ralph Metcalf, who were very powerful African-American politicians who were allied with Mayor Daley. You know, it's interesting, he was an opponent of the war in Vietnam. This is something that David Halberstam was reported about. Yeah, he thought Vietnam was a terrible mistake. Actually, according to David Halberstam, it was one of the reasons why Lyndon Johnson withdrew when he did. Because Mayor Daley said to him, you know, Mr. President, I'll stick with you whatever it takes, even if the policy fails. You know, even if thousands more young men have to come home in caskets, you're our president and I'll support you, even if it's a failing policy. In other words, he understood that Daley thought it was a failing policy. It just, Mayor Daley was of a mentality where, although he was opposed to the war in Vietnam, nothing was more important to him than supporting the machinery that existed. And I think that was a drawback on an issue as significant as that. I don't mean to in any way portray Richard M. Daley as some sort of New Age flower child, because that wouldn't be true. But he is a dedicated environmentalist. He marches in the gay rights parade. He has been very inclusive in his administration. And he actually had one of the best answers I've ever gotten in an interview. When I asked him years ago, a not very bright question, something like, you know, wouldn't your father roll over in his grave or something like that to see you in the gay rights parade? He had a great answer. He said, first thing I want to say is, I don't know why people say that, because I want to tell you I never heard a bigoted word from my dad in our house. And I have to accept his word on that. So the second thing I'd say is, you know, I don't know why people say that to me. I mean, my father's been dead for 25 years. I don't know what he'd be in favor of. Do you? But yeah, that was a great answer, of course. Why are we inferring something, you know, something about that? So I think he's a different man. I don't know if he certainly doesn't have his father's strong political control, and not even really his sense of purpose or vision for the city. On the other hand, he manages it very well. He certainly has opened it to the world. And I think he's, I don't mind saying, you know, it'd be hard to quarrel with the city over which he has presided for the past generation. There are still terrific iniquities, obviously of wealth, of class, that continue to exist in Chicago and perpetuate themselves, as they do all over America. I don't know if Chicago has been more or less successful than any other American city that way. On the other hand, he decided a few years ago, nothing keeps a good tax base like improving the public schools, and quadrupled the budget. and made it open to experimentation. And, you know, I think they're doing a lot of interesting and good things. They're almost to the point where there are people actually moving in from the suburbs to the city to take advantage of the special programs in the schools. And I think that was just a brilliant thing to do. And arguably, only a really powerful and determined mayor could have done that. And you know, he had to run up against the teachers' union because they're hiring some people who are not from traditional teaching backgrounds. A powerful Democratic mayor can do that in a way that someone who was in a funny way ostensibly more of a reformer probably couldn't.
For Between the Covers, this is Jim Schumach, my guest today, novelist and journalist Scott Simon. His most recent novel, Windy City, has just been published by Random House. Truly wonderful to have you drop by this morning, Scott. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. It's been wonderful. Thank you.